It is time we summon Habbo. Habbo. Oh no.
Habbo.
Habbo, can you hear me?
Habbo.
Habbo. Woe to you, O earth and sea. I need to get that pulled up so I can actually read it. I don't remember.
He who hath understanding.
For he who hath understanding.
Mike, what are you doing Wednesday night?
Wednesday night, I'm probably around. What's up? If you would like to book Micah Hanks for your event or party, contact Race Hobbs at KGRA, the official booking service of Micah Hanks. Hobbs. We'd love to get Mike out here.
What about me? Is nobody booking me these days?
Well, I was kind of thinking, Matt, that we could just... Come together. We'll just do, you know...
10 seconds.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Haven't got much time.
In 5.
Oh.
4.
No.
3.
Okay.
2. 1. We're live.
Fantastic.
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker. Welcome one and all, it is the Grillion Report. I am proud, as always, to be your host, Micah Hanks. And you have locked in for another couple of hours of the esoteric, as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, via KGRARadio.com, our home, our hub, on the web. Joining me in studio, as always, the Reverend with the kind eyes, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, as always.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm not obviously in studio, as always. I was gone last week, but I'm happy to be here this week.
Yeah, back in black and back in action. Boy, I tell you, Matt and I recently had to run to the hills. I'll tell you all about that here in a moment. And, of course, later in the program, we're going to be looking at how there is a movement to go off-planet, an actual breakaway civilization. What does this have to do with Norse mythology? We'll tell you more about that later. Also, get into a few urban legends, myths, conspiracies, and the latest news of the weird. Be sure, in the meantime, of course, as we're broadcasting wherever you are, if you're near your computer or smartphone, go right now to Gaia.com/Grailian. Check out our friends and sponsors there at Gaia, people who keep us live and kicking on the airwaves. More on that a bit later, but do check them out. Proud sponsors of the Grailian Report. And back in Master Control, our producer extraordinaire in Fort Smith, Arkansas, Mr. Race Habbo Hobbs. How you doing, Habbo?
Habbo.
Sounds good to me.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
I'm good, guys. I'm good. How y'all doing?
Doing marvelous, Habbo.
Wonderful. Great weekend. At the Transformation Conference up in Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Oh.
Everybody up there says hello, Micah. Yeah.
Well, indeed, yes, especially those lovely ladies, those Arkansas ladies. You know, they love me.
They love the Micah.
Yes, indeed.
They love the doctor.
They do love the doctor, don't they? Boy, Matt and I did a little time traveling over the weekend. We time traveled all the way back to the 1980s. Yeah. All the way back to the 1980s and to an Iron Maiden concert.
We did.
Oh my gosh.
It was pure rock fury.
This is true. This really happened. I mean, here's the thing about that. Again, well, we didn't really time travel, but we felt like we were time traveling because Iron Maiden, on their North American Book of Souls tour, they came to Charlotte. Now, of course, they were the headliner, but their opening act was Ghost. I've wanted to see Ghost for a very, very, very long time. And we get there. Matt was our Minister of Transportation, lined up transportation for us with a friend from work who successfully got us there. But unfortunately, we had to park 2 miles from the venue because for this Iron Maiden North American tour stop, there were 16,000 people that showed up. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up. We thought that by leaving a half hour early, that we would have plenty of time, being only 12 minutes from the venue, to get there, to get parked, and to get in there. Worst case scenario, we might miss Ghost's first song. And Jason Pentrail and I, as we were walking along, we had Adam Sane from Conspiranormal too. I mean, it was like a podcasting, Unity meetup or something. I mean, we had Adam Sane from Conspiranormal, Jason Pentrail, who's been a frequent guest on the show, Matt and I of the Graylian Report, and here we're all walking up together, and we hear the end of the song Monstrance Clock echoing off the valley as we're walking up, and I'm thinking, oh, great. But we didn't expect that 16,000 people. I mean, we got there and it looked like Woodstock. I thought it was going to be a rock show. I mean, it looked like Woodstock. It was insane. But it was really rocking and rolling. I loved it.
It was great.
Iron Maidens, they're legends.
They truly are legends. And I got to tell you, Bruce Dickinson, not only is he a pilot and he flies them to their gigs, but... He puts on such a show. He runs around that stage like it's nobody's business. And Dave Murray and Adrian Smith, I mean, all the guitarists, and of course Steve Harris, the bass player, I mean, they're all such good musicians. That the way that they perform, I mean, it was truly the best rock concert I've ever been to.
It was, I give it the awards for loudest. And one of the best. I'd say it's up there in the top five.
It was definitely, yeah. It was really loud, but you know, I got to tell you, afterward, my ears weren't ringing normally. Like when we saw Zach Sabbath, I mean, my ears rang until the next day. But I think because it was an outdoor concert, it was extremely loud, but yeah, my ears were okay. I usually have to use hearing protection. Yeah, but anyway, so we did a little time traveling. It really did feel like going back to the 80s and getting to hear them sing all these classic Iron Maiden tunes. Really, really neat stuff. Let's see. What else was going on over the weekend? I did treat Jason and Adam to a bit of time in the land of the sky. I haven't done this very often. Hobbs just wrote Kofefi in the chat room there. It's hilarious.
I hope you liked my meme that I came up with. I invented a new meme.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I expect everybody out there in radio land and podcast land to go in, out there and pick it up. It's on the Graylian Twitter, my Twitter. It's Agent Dale Cooper with a fresh cup of Kofefi. I'm still having trouble figuring this exact pronunciation out.
Right. McNonymous.
Kofefi.
I say Kofefi. I say Kofefi. Kofefi. That's how I say it. But McNonymous maintains that it is Kofefi. Or rather, he says Kofef, as though to say like a Kofef in the night, which is what we titled the last episode of Middle Theory about, not the most recent, the one before that. So the last one, but not this one, if that makes sense. Yeah. By the way, again, I often hear from people in the audience and they say, we hear you talk about Middle Theory all the time. What is that? We didn't know that Michael was a host of that show. And Matt occasionally also co-hosts that.
Yeah.
That is a political, well, it's not just politics, because you say politics and a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I'm immediately not interested. I mean, it is news and current events. And we talk about a lot of stuff, not just politics, but we did cover a bit of the Kofefi thing. If you would like to hear our thoughts about that, the non-news story that it was, yeah, head over to middletheory.com. But I liked the Dale Cooper with the cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Have a nice cup of Kofefi. Okay, that's what I did also this weekend.
Yeah.
You know, with my streaming account with Showtime, even though I don't have a television in the bunker, I was able to stream the live show last night. And revisited it again this morning because certain elements of the latest edition of Twin Peaks, episode 6 is the one we're on, certain elements were so strange to me I had to watch it a couple of times. I got to tell you though, man, it's a slow build. I mean, it's a limited series. I really think, I mean, if they're going to get into this and really tell this story, I mean, they're sure taking their time. We're 6 episodes in. I mean, I won't tell you anything beyond that. I'm just going to say, and I think that for those at home who've watched it, you kind of know what I'm talking about. It was quite a slow build. Yeah. Anyway, maybe we'll get into some news here, because the other day I did an unusual thing. I actually stopped out. I should do this more often because I do support good journalism. I bought a newspaper because here we had the Comey hearings, okay? James Comey, former FBI director. This was all front page news. But I could not believe what I was seeing on the front of the New York Times, because although that was the main story on page A1, the page A6 story was the main image on the front page. Okay. While the story was on A6, the picture was of this, ancient human jaw. Okay. Representative of not only an early human, but one who existed 300,000 years ago. And I was amazed that that would be the front page story with all this news of politics and stuff going on. And I was actually a bit inspired, relieved to see that, because in midst of all of the, I'm not trying to say that things going on in current news and politics aren't important. That's why I do a whole separate podcast, Middle Theory, about that. But I think it's important that in the broader picture, in the grand scheme of things, that we recognize those things which are going to be recognized as cornerstones in the history of thought and also discovery as it relates to humans and what role we play and really what our origins have been. And this story is one of the biggest we've seen in a really, an unprecedented string of similar stories. We've had the allegations that there are 130,000-year-old human sites in North America. Archaeological community in North America largely dismisses this, but then we find evidence of humans existing 100,000 years earlier than previously thought. Here's what's been reported. Archaeologists have unearthed 300,000-year-old fossilized bones of early humans, which, according to The Verge, New York Times, and many other news outlets, are the oldest remains of Homo sapiens yet discovered. And this according to two new studies. These ancient bones contain a mix of modern and primitive features that hint at an early and previously unknown phase of our species' evolution. Now, on the family tree of human relatives, collectively known as hominins, our ancestors split from the Neanderthal branch more than 500,000 years ago. Fossils that looked like modern humans started showing up in East Africa about 200,000 years ago, but when exactly modern human evolution took place, and when we evolved from our most recent ancestor, probably Homo heidelbergensis, the Heidelberg man, is indeed a mystery. We don't know exactly when that stage in human development began to more closely resemble what we are now today. But these two new studies published in the Journal of Nature fill in some of those missing millennia and suggest again that hominins were well on their way to looking like modern-day humans as early as 300,000 years ago. And that's quite a game changer. The fossils come from an archaeological site in Morocco called Jebel Iraud. Hominin bones were first pulled out of this location in the 1960s and were dated to about 40,000 years ago. But archaeologists at that time did not have mastery of the sets of skills and the processes which would allow for the proper dating like we do today. Experts began to suspect maybe that that date could be wrong. So, and again, this underscores something that I'm constantly talking about on this show. How often do we look back at something that we thought that we had the answers to, and we look back years later with better technology and maybe with a clearer vision as it relates to what we could be dealing with, and we go back and we reconsider what we thought we knew, and we find, my gosh, we were wrong all along. It was right under our nose, whether it be a new species in the Smithsonian or the improper dating of ancient human remains, thought only to be 40,000 years old. Yeah, try 300,000 years old. So in 2004, this site reopened, and over the next 7 years, archaeologists unearthed more hominin remains, including parts of skulls and jawbones. They also found animal bones that had been butchered and possibly cooked, and then stone tools that had been burned at some point, all in the same layer of dirt. And that's key because, again, being in that same layer in situ alongside one another gives that stratigraphic sequencing that we need. Okay? And that also, of course, in layman's terms, means that these are all essentially the same age, all these things found together. The stone tools were a lucky find because they gave researchers a chance to date the layer precisely. Okay? The stone, well, there are a lot of things you can tell from stone tools. We won't get into that right now. But, you know, certain things can be told from the types, the shapes, radiocarbon dating, a lot of things. But in this case, also measuring how many electrons accumulated in the tools over millennia had been useful to the researchers because they were able to date the layer where the tools were found and the hominin bones within it. And so they actually dated to, and this is fairly precise, 315,000 years ago. Furthermore, there was burning on those stone tools, which gave, of course, a way to date the layer containing the hominin remains. Yeah, that's right. That burning on the tools, that makes it very easy for carbon dating. Jason Pentrell and I, when we've gone down and visited the university, they always tell us, if you find anything that has charcoal on it, man, wrap it up. Don't put it in plastic. Put it in tinfoil. But yeah, that's always what you want to try and do. This is, again, another one of these discoveries that's really changing the way we think about ourselves, about history, about evolution. This has been an incredible year, though, and I cannot emphasize that greatly enough. 2017, we have seen more significant discoveries along these lines than in any year previously that I can recall.
Well, you had mentioned a moment ago about how we look back and we say, man, how did we not get this before? But technology and things allow us to get so much further and understand the past so much more. Think about a million years from now. Think about 300,000 years from now, something like that. When people of the future, if we get there, are looking back on us and how interesting and enthralling our culture will be. And then they'll crack open a vault of radioactive waste and kill off the population.
Yeah, right. I thought you were going to go in a little different direction there. I thought you were going to say, and they're going to open this vault and they're going to go down there and they're going to find a radio studio and the skeletons of two dudes.
Just sitting here till the day we die.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was Micah and Matt in the Doomsday Vault, otherwise known as the Bunker. There you go. By the way, quick shout out to everybody there in the chat room. The Grim Stakes in there, I see. John, Blue Orb, Quintera, Susan, everybody. So good to see you guys in there. If you're listening at home and you aren't there yet, you can head over to kgraradio.com/chat. That's the way to join us any time of the day, any place, anywhere in the world. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. At Micah Hanks on Twitter. Also, you've got at Graylien Report, Graylien Report. That's a way that you can reach us, too. So we would love to hear from you guys. Do be sure and follow the Graylien Reverend also at his Twitter handle.
Which is at Graylien Reverend.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Speaking of hominins, humans, our ancient ancestors, some of our cousins that are alive today, the non-human types, but the ones, you know, that will still look a little like us. Recently, a New York State appeals court rejected an appeal filed by the Non-Human Rights Project seeking for legal rights for a pair of captive chimpanzees. This was reported by the Washington Post. Now, Tommy and Kiko, the chimps in question here, will have to remain in their cages for the time being. As it was reported, a New York State appeals court unanimously agreed that the two chimps named as the plaintiffs in the case are not persons and are thus not deserving of the same bodily autonomy protections afforded for humans. The petitioning lawyers were hoping to see the chimps released and sent to a sanctuary. Tommy's currently caged in a warehouse, and this at a trailer dealership in Gloversville, New York. Kiko is in a storefront cage in Niagara Falls. Now, writing for Gizmodo, George Dvorsky had said, you know, the justices unwilling to establish a bombshell precedent at the state justice level simply hand-waved the Non-Human Rights Project argument aside and ignored the mountain of scientific evidence. He says, again, and I want you to listen to this, folks, the mountain of scientific evidence presented at the case, including an expert affidavit submitted by renowned primatologist Jane Goodall. I want to read to you a little from this summary, which includes the scientific evidence presented in the case. They wrote, chimpanzees have many human-like capabilities. These include recognizing themselves in reflections. That's a big one. Setting and acting toward goals such as obtaining food. Undergoing cognitive development with brains having similar structures to those of humans. Communicating about events in the past and their intentions for the future, such as by pointing or using sign language. Exhibiting an awareness of others' different visual perspectives, such as by taking food only when it is out of their competitor's line of sight. Here's another. Protecting others in risky situations, such as when relatively strong chimpanzees will examine a road before guarding more vulnerable chimpanzees as they cross that road. They can deceive others, implying that they're able to anticipate others' thoughts. Making and using complex tools for hygiene, socialization, communication, hunting, gathering, fighting, counting, and ordering items using numbers. They can engage in moral behavior, such as choosing to make fair offers and ostracizing chimpanzees who violate social norms. So they're chimpanzee philosophers, Matt. They engage in collective behavior such as hunting in groups of chimpanzees adopting different roles, showing concern for the welfare of others, particularly their own offspring, but also siblings and even orphans that they adopt. And finally, they protect territory and group security, resolving conflicts. And finally, chimpanzees, apparently, most didn't probably know this, but they can apologize too and make amends. Quite an impressive list, Dvorsky writes, of cognitive traits, and yet apparently not enough to sway the judges. That said, Weber described the group's mission as laudable and admitted this, the judge, by the way, Weber. He described the group's mission as laudable and admitted that it's, quote, an issue better suited to the legislative process. Well, you know, I don't know. I guess I have mixed feelings about this because it really comes down to, as we're seeing with, you know, our own origins, we don't know at what point we became what we are and ceased being what came before us. But we have things in the world around us today that aren't quite like us and yet display an incredible amount of consistent similarities.
Now, this is a little bit more of an extreme case, and I find it a little bit more interesting as far as Goodall and some people talking about the social structure of the chimpanzees. But people go so far with their own morality that they have to project their morality on other species. So in that projection, we say, well, this animal is afforded this right, even though there's really no similarity of consciousness or social structure in that particular species. So
Do you think that applies to chimps, though?
That's why this one gets interesting. Because even a right to legal right over your own body, what's a chimp going to do with that?
They're going to run around and they're going to steal things. I think the chimps should just be assimilated into society. We just need to assimilate the chimps into society, though.
How would we do such a thing?
Well, it's obvious. I mean, we just legislate it, like Dvorsky was saying right there. Maybe that's a little too much. But
that's the hope, I think, is that we can just legislate things away. For a lot of people, I think that is.
I think that this is a valid and serious issue. But then again, I guess at the end of the day, nonetheless, chimpanzees are going to have to be treated differently from humans. So what I think it always comes back to, all joking aside, is that we do need to have, I guess, realistic expectations. But yes, I think that it is indeed, and again, like Weber in the decision said, you know, what the group's mission was laudable and an issue better suited to the legislative process. Well, I think it is, and perhaps it should be something that is left to the legislative process, but maybe there should continue to be activity and a movement behind this, because I think that, you know, again, as humans, it's a funny situation. Like you kind of said, Matt, we have the higher ground here, so to speak, but we have to look at other animals from time to time, and on what grounds do we compare them to humans and make them more like us or less like us? You know, rights for amoebas, I guess, just would never come up to, you know, in a conversation. Rights for houseflies would never come up in a conversation. But
why not? It's a certain level of organic life. So this is the where we take certain ideas to the illogical extreme. But even talking about something like a cow has the exact same rights of freedom of speech or freedom of expression, these type of rights as a human, that is a little bit of an illogical extreme to me as well. As you said, it's projection of morality, because I don't get it. I really think it's an inability to cope with our own morality and or immorality, I suppose.
Perhaps it is a little of that, Matt. However, I would also further say that I think while we can recognize that humans, again, with cognitive development, with social structures and all these kind of things, exist and operate differently from animals. While animals perhaps are not going to operate in those same ways, we as humans, caring, conscientious beings, can try to look after animals better and can try to understand those species which are more similar to us and understand when it is necessary and worthy of, again, perhaps legislating to ensure their safety. Anyway, we could go on all day. It's going to remain a controversial issue, but I think of all the different things we're learning about our own past, and, of course, the things we're learning about animals as they exist today, and the future, and the promise of the creation of new kinds of intelligence, like AI. I wonder one day what it would be like in a world full of very intelligent, superior intelligence, in fact, as represented by machines, and whether they would be arguing for the legal rights of non-robot entities like humans. Food for thought, maybe. But speaking of our friends out there in Animalia that look a little more like us, you know, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is investigating something mysterious that showed up in SoCal recently. It was near the town of La Crescenta, and a fellow who was walking in the forest near that town captured on his cell phone what some say looks like a mystery ape.
Here in Southern California, we've got our fair share of mountain lions, bears, and other critters, but here in La Crescenta, just off the 210 freeway, there may be something different, really different, hiding in the trees.
Jacob Gardner often takes a stroll in the woods during his lunch break. But last week, while walking by himself in La Crescenta,
at first, I heard a bunch of strange noises up in the trees. Figured it was just some types of birds or something like that.
Then, a still uneasiness came over him.
I knew I had a feeling that something was out there and kind of watching me.
Jake pulled out his phone and began shooting video. At first, nothing out of the ordinary.
So confused.
But when he checked the footage a second time.
You can definitely see a torso and four limbs moving around and swinging around in there. It's a pretty obvious kind of a motion.
Officials with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife say they do not know if what was captured in that video was in fact a great ape, but they say that if such an animal is thriving in these woods, it is a serious public safety concern.
These animals are incredibly strong, and they can very easily kill or seriously injure a person, because if it turns out to be an ape, this animal is scared, hungry, out of its element.
How is it possible that a great ape could be swinging around in SoCal?
People import these animals as illegal exotic pets. Now, that's not great, but what happens is these animals get out of control and they either escape or they get too unruly and the owners just let them go.
So, could there be a large primate swinging through the trees in Southern California?
It's pretty hard to tell. However, we think that it's a pretty good possibility that it's some kind of ape.
California Fish and Wildlife says there's no reason to be alarmed right now. They also say they don't want folks going into these woods looking for this animal, whatever it is. They say that these large primates are very dangerous, and should you encounter one, not to make eye contact and back away very slowly.
I also hear that if you don't move at all, they can't see you. Oh, wait, no, that's dinosaurs. Dang it.
Yeah.
This guy, though, again, in the footage that they show, you barely see what could be something swinging from branch to branch in the trees. I have to say, this video, almost like videos of cryptids, it seems to leave a lot to the imagination. But it reminds me of something that Ivan Sanderson wrote about in his book on abominable snowmen back in the 60s. Or was it the 50s? I think it was the 60s that was published. But he had said that presumably that a chimpanzee could survive a mild series of southern winters. I suppose no place better than in California. That would almost be an ideal habitat. The idea that these kind of creatures would exist in a place, you know, further north, like, I don't know, North Carolina, let alone Northern California, seems far less likely. But in that video, again, according to the wildlife experts who looked at it, they said that indeed could have been some kind of an ape swinging from tree to tree. Now, when I first saw that, of course, you know, mystery ape in California, I'm thinking, yeah, there's a long history of...
It makes the mind reel, doesn't it?
Yes, I suppose it does. Really quickly, before we... I think that the break's going to have to catch us here, so we'll have to save this next story for the following segment. I do want to remind you, by the way, this week over at our... sponsors site, Gaia.com, that's G-A-I-A.com. This week on one of their flagship shows, Beyond Belief with George Norrie, a very good friend of the program. In fact, the very gentleman whose show follows this one here on KGRE, Mr. Richard Dolan, he appeared recently to discuss the ongoing relationship between international affairs, secrecy, and unidentified flying objects. We'll give you a little teaser.
You have a passion for this field, Richard. How come?
I think I have a passion for truth. I know it sounds idealistic, but I really think that's what it is. I've always been interested in getting underneath the official truth, the official established verities that I'm supposed to believe. And I've always been of the opinion that there is something behind the scenes. And when I got into the UFO subject years ago, it became clear to me that this was a reality that has been taken seriously by very, very prominent individuals in the national security community, despite the fact that all of the official word is that there's nothing to this. It's all hoaxes, hallucinations, misidentifications. But that's not true. So when I found that there was this great discrepancy, it's the way that I am. I can't let go. And I will continue to try to pry that open.
Indeed he does, Mr. Richard Dolan. Of course, that's some of the kind of content that you can look for there at Gaia, and we definitely recommend that. Our good pal Richard Dolan, hear what he has to say, not only about UFOs, but international politics and world affairs. He really does, I think, the most brilliant job, especially coming from a historical perspective, professionally speaking, at doing that. And these are just some of the things that you'll find at Gaia.com. So if you head over there, be sure and go to Gaia.com. Again, that's Gaia.com/Graylian. That is, of course, the page where you will be able to find information about how you can watch and stream Beyond Belief with George Norrie and the other fine programs that Gaia offers. Gaia.com/Graylian. I want to tell you about what NASA has spotted. Actually, we're looking at about 10 of these things. Could be potentially dangerous. That and a lot more coming up after this break. It is the Graylian Report. From the high mountains of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, keeping you company as always. Monday nights, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. East Coast time here on KGRARadio.com. Joining me is the man with the kind eyes, the Reverend Oakley, my companion and compatriot, who joins me in my space-time travels. Eve to you, sir.
Eve to you.
Eve to all you guys out there. Glad to see all of you. Except for what NASA just spotted. So I saw Susan there in the chat room talking about how the ISS will be visible as it passes over the land of the sky here tonight. Of course, as I understand, according to our monitors here, Matt, we have cloudy conditions above ground.
It does appear that way.
I even hear a report of a sun shower. You remember what Adam Olson always used to tell us coincided with the sun showers? A fox wedding?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
McNonymous used to laugh about that. Still does, in fact.
You mean don't mean that the devil's beating his wife?
Is that another legend associated?
That's the, like, old, you know, wives' tale from the Appalachian parts.
Now, I'd never heard that.
Really?
I'd that's, never
if
heard
the,
that.
If it's raining and the sun's still shining, the devil's beating his wife?
I'd never heard that. Oh, interesting. Okay, a new one. Add that to the list, because we did a segment a while back about how not only do many cultures associate when the sun is shining during a rainstorm or a shower in the afternoon especially with a fox wedding, but a variety of other different kinds of animal weddings. It's just that the fox is the most prevalent of all of those. Oh, look, our good friends at the Anomalist, Patrick Weege and the folks, tweeting out about our program being live on the airwaves. It's so good to have friends in the know. Our friends at NASA, however, are reporting on something a little more concerning, I think. NASA has said it has found, get this, 10 new asteroids or meteors, which it believes have the potential to harm life on Earth. This discovery was made by NASA's asteroid detecting mission, the Near-Earth Object Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, otherwise known as NEOWISE. Now, Amy Mainzer, the NEOWISE principal investigator from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, reported to The Express in the UK that NEOWISE is not only discovering previously uncharted asteroids and comets, but it is providing excellent data on many of those already in our catalog. It is also proving to be an invaluable tool in the refining and perfecting of techniques for near-Earth object discovery and characterization by a space-based infrared observatory. Now, on top of the 10 potentially hazardous objects, NASA says that they have identified 97 other space rocks and have seen an unexplained spike in comet activity. Now, what accounts for this unexplained spike in comet activity? Well, Emily Kramer, a NASA postdoctoral program fellow at JPL and lead author of a paper on the NEOWISE study, has said that comets that have abrupt outbursts are not commonly found, but this may be due more to the sudden nature of the activity rather than their inherent rarity. In other words, she says, it is great for astronomers to view and collect cometary data when they find an outburst, but since the activity is so short-lived, we may simply miss them most of the time. In other words, that could account for why we seem to see this sudden surge in activity. It could have been that they were missed, some of them. Now, the findings come shortly after a group of Czech scientists warned that fragments of asteroids, which could wipe out entire countries, are hidden in the Taurids meteor shower. Our friend Randall Carlson talks about this a lot, Matt.
Yeah.
He brings this up constantly. The startling finding means that experts may not be able to spot the massive space rock hidden in the annual Taurids meteor shower until it is too late. Guys, I don't want to scare anybody, and we're not catastrophists here, although I think that a little catastrophism is healthy, in truth. It helps ensure your long-term survival.
Well, there was something I heard forever ago. One of our mutual favorite, you know, philosophers, writers, rock and roll guys, Henry Rollins, right? He was talking about his good friend David Lee Roth, who he cited as a kind of peroxided Mark Twain back in the day. And he said, you know, he's out there, but he says some really profound things. And so I think this was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and Joe says, Henry, why do you go to all these really dangerous countries at dangerous times for your, like, travel plans?
Let me guess. And he said it's because I hope that I'm going to get struck by a meteor or a comet, right?
Well, no. This goes back to what you're saying. A bit of catastrophism is good, I think. And he said, well, it goes back to what David Lee Roth said. I talked to him on the phone, and I said, what have you been up to? David goes, well, you know, Henry, I've actually just gotten back from deep sea kayaking with sharks. And so Rollins said, why would you go do that? And what David Lee Roth says is, you know, we in America don't deal with certain issues that the rest of the world deals with on a daily basis. And sometimes it's good to have on your agenda, don't get eaten today. And it gives you a little bit of perspective. So catastrophism, I think, gives some perspective to our lives.
Speaking of not being eaten by sharks, head over to graylianreport.com. If you catch the Monday, June 12th news, you'll see a incredible video that I linked as the lead story of a great white shark stranded. It had been unfortunately injured by, well, I don't know, unfortunately or fortunately, maybe depending on how you look at it. I know nobody likes to see animals injured. But then again, I don't want to be eaten by a great white shark. And this shark had gotten stranded in shallow water. And this guy gets just within a few feet of this great white as it's out there. And at one point, the thing lifts its head out of the water and starts snapping its mouth. Whew, I tell you. See, you don't like snakes, but a lot of people out there have that same aversion to sharks. I don't know if you've ever gone swimming in the ocean.
Oh, absolutely. I've never had the big aversion to sharks.
Well, I tell you, after I watched enough of these documentaries and the real kicker was meeting a guy at the Wild Wing Cafe one day, and he says, you remember about that shark bite story a couple of years ago in the Myrtle Beach News? And I said, I do recall hearing about an incident like that. And he pulls up his pant leg and shows me the bite. He says, that was me. And they'd, oh my gosh, I mean, the extensive level of reconstructive surgery that that guy had to have done. Yeah, shark bites are a real threat. So are snake bites, Matt. But I tell you,
even more of a threat here.
While those things are viewed as being imminent threats to many people, especially who go outdoors, less often do we hear about the realistic threat of comet and meteor strikes. And this is why it's something that we do emphasize on this program from time to time. So again, not to be a catastrophist per se, but I mean, this is something that is a very potentially dangerous, I mean, potentially earth-changing kind of a situation, and yet people don't pay as much attention to that. You know, I don't know, it just kind of baffles me. According to this group of researchers, by the way, it's suggested that one of the fragments could hit Earth. And these, again, these massive space rocks hidden in the annual Taurids meteor shower, they're saying that there are chances and estimates that indicate the likelihood that Earth could be hit in one of the following years by one of these, okay? We've got a possible strike that could occur in 2022. We've got a possible strike that could occur again in 2025. They estimate another could occur in 2032 and another in 2039. Now, experts from the Astronomical Institute of the Czech Academy of Science said, since asteroids of sizes of tens to hundreds of meters pose a threat to the ground, even if they are intrinsically weak, impact hazard increases significantly when the Earth encounters the Taurid new branch every few hours. Further studies leading to the better description of this real source of potentially hazardous objects, which can be large enough to cause significant regional or even continental damage on Earth, are thereby extremely important. All I have to add to that is, you think? And yet, so many people don't think so. I think this is perhaps the most important thing about what Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson talk about. You may disagree, as I do, on certain points as it relates to this idea of an advanced ancient civilization, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong on all points. And when I see the skeptically minded playing down the threat and asking, well, why do you guys even think a comet could have struck Earth? I'm sorry, we need to be aware and we need to be prepared to potentially deal with the threats that these kind of things may present. Hey, let me take just a second to tell you about another potential threat, one that comes from the Razorist. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes.
The Razorist?
Yes.
That's right. He's one of those razors that hangs around in Matt Oakley's bathroom. One of those rusty ones that barely shaves. Look at all the stubble all over your face. I remember that Sherlock Holmes story in which he's deducing that Watson likes to shave in the open light of the window next to him with no lights on in his bathroom because he can tell that one side is more well-shaved than the other and that the other is downright slovenly. Matt doesn't actually look like that. Dear old Watson, you know my methods. And my methods, by the way, involve the Dollar Shave Club. No, this isn't another one of those Lover's Lane stories. The Razorist, of course, is something that anybody out there can get around having to encounter. Okay? You can be another one of those who stops wasting your time. Like, for instance, I did. I stopped wasting time that I could have been spending doing show prep for a show like this. Make the smart choice and switch to the Dollar Shave Club. Now, look, listeners of this program know that I've definitely become a fan of the Dollar Shave Club. I've heard about them for ages, and I finally gave them a try. And I can tell you, it was better than I expected. I've had a lot of people, by the way, asking me about it. I mean, just over the weekend, some of the guys were asking about it. Now, again, I'll just ask, don't you think it's about time that you step up your routine with an incredible game-changing shave from Dollar Shave Club? Their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter beats any shaving cream I've used. As I've told you, it's transparent, and that really helps a lot with it. But keep this in mind, too. Your dad may grow a beard if he's not able to shave. My dad has a beard, but he still shaves, too, around the beard, right? You got to keep that beard in shape if you're a dad out there. And with Father's Day right around the corner, what better gift is there to give than a membership to Dollar Shave Club? That is a really good one. I could think of a lot of really great gifts, but, I mean, this is simple, it's effective, and again, if you're a guy, in likelihood, at some point, at some time, you're going to have to shave. And so you should treat your dad right this Father's Day. Help him out. Now, look, right now, again, new members get their first month off the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. It's only $5. That's with free shipping, and after that, the razor is just a few bucks a month. No hidden fees, no commitments either. You cancel anytime you like. And you don't have to go to the store anymore and get lost in the wall of razors, as I like to call it, looking for cheap, disposable razors that aren't going to work real well, Mr. Watson.
You call it the wall of razors?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Although I'm noticing that the wall of razors is slowly dwindling. You're seeing less and less of it because more and more people are rushing online and getting their razors, quality razors, sent to their house. They don't even have to go to the store any longer. So look, join the club today, right now. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/Micah. That's how you find it. My name, dollarshaveclub.com/Micah. You too can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. And as for me, again, I'm going to keep working on dear Mr. Watson here. Now, when we come back from this break, Matt, gosh, we've got so much we want to get to here. This is one of the most interesting phenomena, and Matt actually dug up some good information for us about this. What happens when someone is pronounced clinically dead, and then they come back to life? Yeah, we'll look at this near-death mystery when we return here on the Graylian Report. It is the Graylian Report. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time here in this segment discussing something rather unusual. It's known as the Lazarus Phenomenon. I don't know if you've ever heard about this. Medical News Today had carried a story about this. Now, in 2001, there was a 66-year-old man who experienced cardiac arrest while undergoing surgery for an abdominal aneurysm. Thank you, by the way, Matt. I had to send this young lad into the other room here to be able to keep me on the air. We've got a thunderstorm above ground, and I have to tether and make sure that I have power to my primary unit.
Got to insulate ourselves.
That's right. Insulate yourselves. Bunker down. We're good to go. Okay, so the 66-year-old man, he had been undergoing surgery for an abdominal aneurysm. And after about 17 minutes of resuscitation efforts incorporating CPR, defibrillation, medication, the man's vital signs eventually just ceased. And he was pronounced dead. They could not get any vital signs to return. And then 10 minutes later, his surgeon felt a pulse, and he was alive. And the operation continued. His outcome, of course, was that he survived and he was just fine. We also had, at 91 years old, a woman, Jana Kolsowitz, who was declared dead. 11 hours later, she awoke in the hospital mortuary with a craving for tea and pancakes. She was just one of the many kinds of people, as we've reported here, who have been reported to have risen from the dead. Now, this so-called Lazarus phenomenon, or Lazarus syndrome, is defined as a delayed return of spontaneous circulation after CPR has ceased. In other words, patients who are pronounced dead after cardiac arrest experience an impromptu return of cardiac activity. I'm sure you can probably kind of figure out, after Lazarus of Bethany, okay, from the New Testament, you probably get the idea of where this name comes from. Another guy, again, who allegedly rose from the dead, but he had, of course, the miracles of Christ on his side to be able to help him do that. But since 1982, when the Lazarus phenomenon was first described in medical literature, there have been at least 38 reported cases of this. Now, according to a 2007 report, in around 82% of Lazarus syndrome cases to date, this phenomena tends to occur within 10 minutes of CPR being stopped, and around 45% of patients experienced good neurological recovery. But while the low number of report cases might highlight the rarity of the so-called Lazarus syndrome, scientists nonetheless believe that it's much more common than the studies suggest. What exactly causes it? There are theories, but we don't really know. Now, Dr. Vahibai Sani, in this 2016 report that was filed last year on this, he's a what we call a nephrologist. Okay, he says that the Lazarus phenomena is a grossly underreported event. And in that report from last year, he wrote, the reason for these can be attributed to the fact that metacollegial issues are brought to light in cases which are pronounced dead, which later turn out to have been alive. The professional expertise of the resuscitating doctor can be brought into question, not to mention the fact that such an event can lead to disrepute among colleagues. Here's another thing. Another pertinent question that arises is whether the death of a particular patient occurred as a result of premature cessation or resuscitative efforts or the omission of continued resuscitation altogether. So precisely what causes the Lazarus phenomena remains unclear, but again, the theories range from a number of things, which might include resuscitation, or perhaps also medications and delayed action as a result of those medications used as part of the resuscitation efforts. It is possible that drugs injected through a peripheral vein are inadequately delivered centrally due to impaired venous return, and when venous return improves after stopping the dynamic hyperinflation, delivery of drugs could contribute to return of circulation, according to the report. Then we have what's called hyperkalemia, whereby blood levels of potassium are just too high. In another proposed explanation for the Lazarus phenomena, it's been linked to delayed resuscitation efforts. So, because so few cases of Lazarus syndrome are reported, uncovering the exact mechanism behind the condition is tricky, but perhaps it's not what is bringing a patient back to life that we should be concerned about. Again, maybe they were never deceased. Again, everything I've found in the literature, Matt, seems to suggest that this isn't as uncommon as sometimes made out to be in the medical community.
That seems to be the case, and there was a piece I found in The Guardian that says even within the medical community itself, there's a debate over what really constitutes death, and it is seen less as a single event, more as a process. It involves several different mechanisms ceasing, not just one.
Can I just interject very quickly that, again, the idea that, oh, well, we're not really sure what death is. I mean, clinically speaking, there are a lot of processes that constitute death. This ties in so well with what we talked about with Dr. Kolbaba last week and the near-death experiences. Well, you weren't here for that, but riveting conversation, I'll just tell
it
you.
It was.
Got a lot of... did you hear it?
I did.
Got a lot of great feedback about that. But again, I mean, there seem to be a variety of different things that are happening, perhaps on the operating table, and aspects, I suppose, of the death experience that we do not fully understand, scientifically speaking. We know that death marks the end of a life. What are the things, what are the factors that are, you know, key players in that process? And after what point can someone be apparently clinically dead and then come back? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and that's why there can be ethical arguments around such things as brainstem death, when the person is in fact deceased, but their tissues can be artificially kept alive by some means. When the heart, for whatever reason, stops beating, the tissues, its services, are deprived of both oxygen and glucose, and are subject to a buildup of toxic waste products. This gradually kills the cells. When enough of them die, there is major organ failure, and the body as a whole is said to be dead. The delicate cells of the brain are particularly susceptible to the lack of oxygen, and they will usually begin to die around 4 to 6 minutes.
Okay, so that's the clinical standard.
That appears so.
Okay, according to The Guardian. Well, again, you know, this is a fascinating thing because to me, we take for granted something that every living creature on Earth eventually experiences, and it's something that's so commonplace. It happens to thousands of individuals every day around the world, and yet there are still mysteries associated with it. And obviously, as we saw last week during our discussion about NDEs and OBEs, it's near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences for you laymen out there. We have a lot of questions about death. And I don't think it's morbid to discuss that, especially when certain people who are pronounced dead are waking up thereafter. Not as uncommon as you think, and perhaps not as, you know, macabre either. In fact, it's quite natural. More here in a moment on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Coming back to you from the bunker, I'm Micah Hanks, and it is the Graylian Report. That's right, our eyes on the ground above have advised that we start building an ark, Matt.
It seems that way.
Yeah, there is some serious weather that has struck the Carolinas. Hopefully that won't interrupt our live stream. Of course, it is very well grounded here below ground. It used to not be. We used to have some problems, I think.
That's right.
Yes, but I mean,
I just hope we're not being smote.
I don't think anyone shall smite us. Indeed. Yes, no one shall smite us despite us. Hey, by the way, head on over to graylianreport.com/X if you would like to subscribe. We just picked up a couple of new subscribers over the weekend. That is indeed one of the best ways to get the full picture and the full effect of the Graylian Report. You will get not only a weekly additional podcast, we affectionately call it the additional edition. That's the Graylian X podcast. But you get a customized feed that has not only this full 2-hour podcast, an additional hour-long podcast, and then also the monthly Graylian Enigmas and some other goodies that we put up from time to time, too. Just sometimes when we're feeling like it, we'll put up a video or we'll put up some sort of a special roundtable or something like that. I want you to ask yourself, how many podcasts out there do you know that give you 2 full hours for free? And then also, for subscribers, for just $7 a month, offer you an additional hour and a monthly special. The very theatrical Graylian Enigmas. I think, in truth, in my personal opinion, one of the best deals in podcasting. And you don't have to spend as much as you will for other podcasting packages.
And you get to hear us.
And you get to hear us. What's not to like about that? Yeah, so it's truly great. GraylianReport.com/X.
So, Micah, I wanted to just completely hijack the first little bit of this hour.
All right, okay? I'll let you.
I want to pull on your coat about something. I don't know if you saw this. I don't think you did. But I wanted to throw a surprise segment at you. IFLScience.com had an article posted today saying, definitively, here's what happened at Roswell in 1947.
Wait, Roswell? What happened at Roswell? But that can only mean one thing. That the mystery is finally solved?
Or it must have been the aliens.
Oh, no. Cowboy Matt. You hear that? It really must have been.
Okay, so I wanted to throw some of this information out at you that they've got here and see if you just started screaming, pulling your hair out, whatever.
Okay,
you
know. All right, yeah. I'll fact check this.
Okay, live. This is why you guys subscribe to us, right?
Yeah.
So, it all began on a fateful day back on July 7th, 1947. That was when a rancher in Roswell, New Mexico, called Mac Brazel, discovered some strange debris in his sheep pasture. This consisted of sticks, bits of metal, and a foil-like sheet that regained its structure when crumpled. Unsure what it was, he spoke to the local sheriff, who in turn got in touch with the Roswell Army Air Force Base, hereafter referred to as RAAF.
Okay.
They sent out Major Jesse Marcel, who excitedly thought he might be seeing the remains of an extraterrestrial flying saucer. Flying saucers were big news at the time, with the term only originating 2 weeks before. It was accidentally coined by aviator Kenneth Arnold on June 24, 1947, when he described seeing flying objects in the sky moving like a saucer skimming on water. These comments were taken out of context, and the flying saucer was born. So when on July 8th, the RAAF sent out a press release saying they had recovered a flying disc, people were understandably excited. The following day, the Roswell Daily Record published an infamous front-page story, RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region.
Which we, of course, have directly behind me here on the wall in the studio.
Yeah. The U.S. Air Force sought to quell speculation by stating the next day that the debris was from a weather balloon. At the time, this seemed like a satisfactory explanation, and the story was dropped. But decades later, it would be the catalyst for ufologists to run wild. Quote, Roswell has got everything, really, Nigel Watson, author of the Haynes UFO Investigation Manual, told IFL Science.
Okay, that's the first question I have. If it was written by Nigel Watson, why is it called the Haynes UFO Investigation Manual?
I smell a conspiracy brewing at
perhaps
this point.
Yeah. I actually know about that book. It's regarded as one of the best and one of the newer books of quality on investigation of UFOs. Although I prefer Alan Hendry's book, The UFO Handbook, which is arguably, despite the fact, sadly, that most people who study UFOs don't know about it, never have heard about it, and many of them don't even know who Alan Hendry was, it is by far the most scientific evaluation of UFOs as far as a popular book, which teaches prospective UFO hunters how to apply science and be skeptical, probably, that has ever been written on the subject. So if you have not heard of it and you're interested in UFOs, I don't think it's any longer in print, but you can buy used copies on Amazon, and ladies and gents, they're going fast. So, yeah, The UFO Handbook by Alan Hendry. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So they also bring up good friend Stanton Friedman.
The first civilian investigator on the field there looking for Roswell, despite not being the first author. Okay, it was Charles Berlitz and Bill Moore who wrote the first book on Roswell, but they cited a lot of the research of Stanton, who was on the ground at the time.
Yeah, so they quote him as saying, quote, I have concluded that the Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled vehicles whose origin is extraterrestrial. He told that to a committee of the House of Representatives previously in 1968. This doesn't mean I know where they come from, why they are here, or how they operate. He spoke to supposed witnesses about Roswell, some of whom told him fantastical stories. There were tales of alien autopsies, secretive extraterrestrial technology, and more. Thinking he had found a monumental cover-up, he made his research public, which became the basis of the book, The Roswell Incident in 1980.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Friedman had actually discovered a cover-up, but sadly, it had nothing to do with aliens or flying saucers.
Let's see if I can predict, Mr. Watson. Okay. They believe that there was a cover-up of what was called Project Mogul, which was a U.S. Air Force. No?
Yeah, you just... It's amazing. I love watching you work. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Inadvertently uncovered was a secret U.S. Cold War program called Project Mogul. This involved using high-altitude balloons equipped with microphones to monitor atomic bomb tests being performed by the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, this information was not made public by the U.S. Air Force until 1994. This meant that there was more than a decade of speculation about Roswell until the real story actually came to light. And it wasn't just a crashed flying saucer getting people worked up. It was also stories of alien bodies being recovered and taken to Area 51 for autopsies. Again, there was a simple explanation. Do you want to take any guesses on this one, or
the secret explanation? Oh, the secret, or is it a simple explanation?
Simple explanation
for what may have been misconstrued as the bodies.
Yes.
Okay. My guess would be that with Project Mogul, I don't believe that there were actual humans involved. I think that there were crash test dummies of sorts that were appended to parachutes, and that this is what they were wheeling away that people mistook for aliens.
You're killing it. You are killing it.
Well, I know my Roswell history here.
So, yes, they said that around the time of the Roswell incident, the military had been using dummies in high-altitude test programs like Operation High Dive. This involved dropping dummies with parachutes from high altitudes that would be fatal to humans to see what happened. Some of these dummies, along with the balloon from Project Mogul, appear to have accidentally fallen near the small, unassuming town of Roswell. And with no official explanation coming for almost 40 years after the incident, things got a bit out of hand.
Now, here's the thing, though. Project Mogul is one of many alleged explanations that's been offered over the years. Another did involve actual pilot, well, I don't know if you'd call them pilots, but I mean people who were involved in these kind of parachuting operations. And one of the guys claimed that he had, at the time of landing, had been so badly injured that he had two black eyes. And he said that the double black eyes, and they showed a photograph of the two swollen eyes. He said that this might have resembled from a distance the two large black eyes of an alien. So he claimed, I may have very well been one of the aliens that the people saw. But the problem is that of course, doesn't jive with the Mogul explanation. And then there are all these other theories. Annie Jacobson, okay, she wrote a book about Area 51, also that great book that Nick Ressler sent us about Operation Paperclip. Her new book, of course, deals with the same sort of stuff that the Men Who Stare at Goats did. Annie Jacobson had a contact who fed her one story, okay, which is sort of similar to what Nick Redfern continues his narrative about in his new book on Roswell, but which began in his book Body Snatchers in the Desert. And in essence, all these stories involve the idea that humans that were either disfigured or people who were experimental test subjects of some kind or something along those lines were involved with an actual crash of an actual aircraft. And that the entire thing, and then the various conspiracies entailed that this was something that was cooked up by Stalin, which was intended to try and confuse. Now, again, let me be clear before anybody says, no, that's not what Nick Redfern's book was about. I'm kind of going over all the, in very quick succession, different theories. And some of these have been espoused in Body Snatchers in the Desert. Some of these have been espoused by Annie Jacobson and Joseph P. Farrell over the years. A lot of different theories, a lot of different interpretations of what might have happened. Some of them trying to reconcile the idea of alien crash victims and why they would have looked alien have gone so far as to say that, again, monkeys with their tails removed and their hair shaved off their bodies, dyed green, were left in the wreckage. I mean, there are so many theories that have surfaced over the years. Again, they state that the Project Mogul thing is conclusively what occurred, that one of the Mogul dummies crashed at Roswell, and that is what happened.
Well, yeah, that's what IFL Science is saying. These two instances of crash test dummies, as well as the weather balloons of Project Mogul, are definitively the explanation behind the Roswell.
But again, the problem I have with that is that while Mogul has been proposed as the explanation, a lot of the aspects of Mogul don't. It seems like there's too little to explain too much with Mogul, and then there are conflicting interpretations and conflicting theories that have nothing to do with crash test dummies and parachutes and the like. So again, I'm not saying that Mogul might not have been what caused Roswell. The problem I have is that this, like so many conflicting explanations, when you get into the realm of skepticism, you often find that the varieties of different explanations that offer a mundane terrestrial explanation for said unexplained phenomena, they tend to conflict with one another. Another great example is Cal Korf and Greg Long's book on Bigfoot a number of years ago, where they explained what showed up in the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know, we have the story that Bob Hieronymus, the retired Pepsi-Cola bottler from Yakima, Washington, made the suit out of horsehide himself, and that it's, or no, I'm sorry, the guy who wore the suit was Bob Hieronymus. He said that Roger Patterson made the suit out of horsehide and that it stunk. Okay, that's what he said. But then you have the same story presented in the same book that I got to try and remember his name. He is a costume maker, Philip Morris. Philip Morris, a costume maker, I think he's still in business down in Charlotte where we were over the weekend.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Philip Morris, okay, says that he sold the suit to Roger Patterson. Mm-hmm. So to reconcile the two stories, Korf and Long kind of cook up this combination where they say that it was a suit that was purchased, but that they added extensions to the arms that were made out of horse hide and all this stuff. So that might be why the suit stunk, according to Bob Hieronymus, who said that it was all made of horse hide and apparently didn't know that he was wearing a suit that was partially constructed by a professional costume maker. But then there's the story that, I don't know. I mean, you know, again, there are any number of stories. I don't want to go down the whole Planet of the Apes thing because I think that that was conclusively debunked. But the point is that when you have a number of skeptical interpretations of the said incident that don't seem to corroborate with each other, I don't understand why skeptics, when they will offer conflicting narratives, they will nonetheless say, well, it doesn't matter because one of these narratives must be true. No, let's get to the bottom of it. Let's get proof. Let's get evidence. Let's get one conclusive story that fits all the descriptions of the phenomena described. Now, look, I don't think that really, in truth, after so many years, that there's enough evidence to suggest that something really happened. I mean, look, no, something did happen at Roswell, but I don't think that there's enough evidence to say that aliens crashed there.
But this collection of stories, you saying that there's so many stories out there, that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that we have gone decades upon decades of conspiracy theory on things like Bigfoot, things like the UFO incident at Roswell, things even like the Kennedy assassination. We have decades and decades of theories and what I would say quote-unquote data, I would loosely define as data, but data nonetheless. So that has muddied the water worse than anything else, worse than any government conspiracy possible. Everybody postulating a different hypothesis and it murkying the water and the real evidence getting lost over time, that's what has been more detrimental to any of these theories, any of these stories, than any sort of real government cover-up or anything like that.
Yeah, see, like when we watched the Joe Rogan podcast with Graham Hancock, Randall Carlson, and Michael Shermer, again, what we find is that sometimes the quote-unquote fringe crazy alternative guys have as much or more knowledge about certain subjects, and the veracity of that knowledge can be confirmed based on historical and scientific data, sometimes, again, in greater magnitude than that offered by the skeptical side, as we saw with Shermer. Now, again, people have come after me and said, why would you guys attack Michael Shermer the way that you did? It's not his job to know those things. He's not the guy who's supposed to know all that stuff. See, this is another thing that I see the skeptical community always putting off on the alternative researchers. Well, sure, and I agree, actually, to the extent that the burden of proof is on those making the extraordinary claim. But when those who counter the extraordinary claim don't have enough knowledge of what they're discussing to be able to counter the claim made, and they offer bad information, as Shermer did. And again, I'm not just beating up on Shermer. I respect him for being a respectable skeptic. He is very warm, polite, pleasant, and engaging. And that's a big plus in his playbook because he's not apparently, fallen completely to this cult of James Randi. And even though I respect Randi, I think that so many skeptics today try to emulate Randi that they just think that they've got to be jackasses, that they have to act very rude, very demeaning, very demanding, in fact. And they will rely on consensus information without seeming to think that they have to do a whole lot of research of their own and yet think that they can deconstruct any argument. What I say is that if you're going to offer a skeptical narrative to explain a perennial favorite conspiracy theory or mystery or something along those lines, which probably does have a mundane explanation like Roswell, let's offer one theory. Now, in the article you read, they offered Project Mogul. That seems to be the predominant theory as to what happened at Roswell. The problem is that there are plenty of other skeptical narratives and those offered by alternative researchers that don't seem to fall in with the Mogul thing. And at some point, you've got to kind of look at this and say, okay, skeptical or otherwise, what is the truth? What best fits the data? Whether it's Bigfoot you're talking about and how this video was hoaxed of a Bigfoot out there in Bluff Creek, or whether it's a UFO crash at Roswell or the lack thereof. Let's get one conclusive, well-documented, historically accurate, and feasible explanation that we can stick with without having to throw whatever sticks on the wall. You know, let's throw it at the wall and see what sticks. That's all these people do, and I see both the alternative researchers and the skeptics doing it. We need conclusive, historically documented, well-represented, traceable, fact-checkable data. That's what we need. See, and that's why I was recently, I came under a bit of attack from someone recently because on the Middle Theory program, we had talked a bit about the Seth Rich conspiracy. Now, here's the deal. My conclusion about that, again, Seth Rich, the DNC staffer, who allegedly, according to some, had been the WikiLeaker, or who had leaked DNC documents to Julian Assange. My end analysis, okay, my determination at the end of the day
was... Yeah, we did that.
You were on that show with me. I said, I think it's a conspiracy theory. I'm not convinced that there's enough evidence that shows this kid did anything that Julian Assange said he did. I said we should at least withhold judgment because the following day there was a report coming out from this guy, Kim.com, saying that, hey, I have proof, I have evidence. Well, what he said, again, could not be fact-checked and verified. And so I maintain that it's still a conspiracy theory, and yet somebody comes after me and sends some very nasty comments and says, you're sticking your neck out for the alt-right, Mike. And by the way, alt-right is a politically correct way of saying neo-Nazi in America today. Now, the thing is, I didn't advocate the conspiracy. We reported on it. And I'm putting my neck out for the alt-right because we reported on it. I'm sorry, it was a significant story in the news. We reported on it. I told you what I thought, but that's not good enough. No, you're a conspiracy theorist, Micah.
Well... You heard it here first, right?
The point is, again, I think that there is a time where you can look at something and you can fairly report on it without having to endorse one ideologically biased idea or another. But the problem is that the ones who, and the very accusation that was made against me in that instance, the person said, well, Micah, you have lost your objectivity on this issue. And I said, to the contrary, I tried to look at the issue objectively, but your bias made you think I said exactly the opposite of what I did. And I'm sure somebody could be listening to this right now and would say, so Mike is actually saying that a UFO crashed at Roswell? I don't think that the evidence, at least what we have, substantiates that. I don't think that there's enough evidence to, again, be the smoking gun. I think most knowledgeable UFO researchers, and I'll cite Kevin Randall here, have come to similar conclusions over the years. Now, again, my buddy Stanton Friedman, on the other hand, he maintains that he thinks that there was a UFO crash at Roswell. And I got to say, although I think... No, I think it's fair to say this, completely fair, and I'll just put it on record. I appreciate Stan, and I enjoy talking to him when I meet him, and he's a good guy, and I cherish Stan and the friendship I have with him, but it's okay to disagree with him, and I do disagree with him. I think that Stan is all in on the UFO equals aliens, and Roswell was real, and MJ-12 was real.
I mean, for God's sake, who do you really agree with 100% of the time?
Honestly... See, that's the thing. There are not many people.
But you have to qualify that nowadays. You have to be like, now I don't agree with so-and-so on everything, but I agree with him on this. There has to be that qualifier these days, and it absolutely makes no sense to me.
Otherwise, oh my God, you're a conspiracy theorist. Again, here, Megyn Kelly on her Sunday night show last night, I meant to bring this up too. She had Alex Jones on there.
You mean Alex?
Yeah. Yeah, she had Alex.
I've been trying to pick this bone with you that you've told me repeatedly over the past several months to go back and watch the Joe Rogan podcast with Alex Jones on there. And that is 4 hours of my life. I'll never get back.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, I felt the same way when I watched The Hateful Eight.
Hey, I liked The Hateful Eight. At least it had artistic integrity.
Yes, it did. It did. Although, again, you know, the violence against women, you know, the destruction of a priceless vintage Martin guitar, I just cannot get behind that. You know, I know it's art and it's just a film, but also, I mean, you know, and I'm not just trying to say that, because again, this is part of the problem I have, is that everybody is triggered by something these days. And what Tarantino is doing is he's trying to make social commentary through the art of film. So I get that. So I'm not saying that the film triggered me, but again, I just hate seeing... It's one thing if you're going to do art. It's another thing if you're going to destroy a vintage Martin guitar. Yeah, that's just not cool. That's not cool. So anyway, but as you were saying, I don't mean to derail you. I digress. Go ahead.
It's okay. I was just going to say I had a bone to pick. 4 hours of my life, I'll never get back. What that man does... I find him hilarious, for one.
Alex Jones?
I mean, yeah. I couldn't stop laughing at him. And I wasn't laughing with him. I was laughing at him.
No, he's funny and he's crazy.
He is. And what he does is poisonous to some people. Like our listenership, you and I, a lot of us really don't take it seriously. But when he sits there and just... one thing after another, like Obama's mother is a sex worker for the CIA and you know, all this stuff, it's like, man, you have no evidence to support it. And Joe keeps asking for evidence. He goes, well, you know, we've got some documents back at InfoWars that I could show you that they blow your mind. Yeah, but you're not giving me evidence and people are believing you, like Eddie Bravo on that show, which is the epitome of why it's dangerous to me. You have somebody like Eddie Bravo sitting there like, man, you just blew my mind, Alex.
Yeah.
Well, of course he did, because who would think up of something like that? There's some secret cabal within the U.S. government that worships interdimensional demons, that and that's why they feed off the souls of children or something, and we're trying to reach another dimensional plane. It's absurd. It is the most absurd thing I've ever heard.
Well, yeah, but see, that's what's interesting, is that Alex does acknowledge the breakaway civilization. In the next segment, I want to talk about a possible real breakaway civilization. Okay, this is something, you talk about blowing your mind. I wish Eddie Bravo were in studio with us right now.
Yeah, right.
But I agree with you, Matt, that, yeah, Alex Jones, even though you and I might watch it and we might think it's entertaining, you know, Jason Pentrell watched it, I think he did. I know James Waldo watched it, and James got a kick out of it. A lot of us watched it, and we find Alex Jones entertaining because we take it as entertainment. But there are plenty of people who are like, and everything he says is true. The human ape hybrids or the Chimeras or whatever, they've been creating in government laboratories for years. Human-animal hybrids. Look, Megan, you can laugh all you want to, but this is true. They're actually doing this. And then there are people who listen to this show, and if they hear me do that impersonation, they get offended. Okay. And they call me, what would you call that, alt-left? So I'm alt-right because we report on the Seth Rich conspiracy, but nonetheless say our determination is that there's not enough evidence. Is Snopes alt-right because they report on it and also call it a conspiracy theory? Yeah, but you guys reported on it. Now, the reason I bring up Alex Jones, Megyn Kelly interviewed him on her program that I believe aired last night.
Yeah, I'm dying to see it.
And now there are people calling for a boycott of Megyn Kelly's show because she interviewed him. Not only did she challenge him on a lot of his claims, but see, again, now, and here's the thing. I've kind of got a personal connection to the Sandy Hook thing.
Yeah.
I've got Mr. McNonymous, good friend of mine. He lives right up there. Okay, he has friends and family right there in Newtown. I have gone and stayed with him with his friends and family in Newtown. We have gone to the new Sandy Hook Elementary School, built at the side of the old one. We have spoken with people personally who worked in the school system and who were there the day that happened. Okay, it's not a conspiracy theory. It happened. It's awful, and it happened. And so I understand why people associated with that are now calling for, you know, they call Alex Jones dangerous, and I agree with them because, again, but see, he says on Megyn Kelly that he's played devil's advocate, that sometimes he'll say it's all true, and then sometimes he'll say it's all phony. Well, then why would you do that?
I don't believe that's true for an instant, but saying it was, it's still dangerous what he does.
It's dangerous what he does, but should people be boycotting Megyn Kelly just for interviewing Alex Jones? See, I don't think that's fair. If you don't like what Alex Jones has to say, don't listen to what Alex Jones has to say. Don't watch his program. But is it wrong for Megyn Kelly to interview this guy?
Oh, hell no.
Is she wrong for having him on her show? Is she dangerous by virtue of giving an audience to Alex Jones if she asks journalistic questions and is tough on him?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we've seen this happen repeatedly in the news media. We had Bill Maher get a petition against him to be banned from the network because he had Milo on.
Yeah.
Like, it's absurd. I don't agree with Milo, and obviously neither did Bill Maher.
Yeah. There was this article, and I'll leave you with this before we go to break here. This was the professor from down the mountain here at the university in Greenville, and he had said he got attacked by a guy, and he said that he evoked the Bigfoot argument. And I was thinking, what is he talking about with the Bigfoot argument? And the way he described it, he says, back in the day, you could have a newspaper report on an alleged Bigfoot sighting. They could go and they could interview a guy who claims that he saw Bigfoot. The guy could claim he saw Bigfoot, and you may not believe him, but then reporting on it wasn't fake news. Nowadays, if somebody reports anything about Bigfoot, even if the news agency isn't saying Bigfoot is real, they report someone claims they saw Bigfoot, and what they've reported is factual, that the person claimed they saw Bigfoot. There's no longer a distinction. If you report on it, you're part of the problem. I just don't agree with that. We'll be right back. It is the Gray Lane Report. From the dark heart of the Hollow Earth, it is the Gray Lane Report. I am Micah Hanks, along with the kind-eyed reverend, whose faint and ghostly glow helps illuminate things. In fact, we hope to be your light in the darkness, help you make sense of the madness out there. And there's plenty of it. The fact, the fake news hemorrhaging from the media, as our friend Victor over there at Area 51 would say. In this segment, I do want to spend a little time talking about something in a slightly different way from what you're used to hearing about. We have talked about this breakaway civilization, and in the last segment, keep in mind, it's very newsworthy that Alex Jones, who I would say is the most visible conspiracy theorist in America today, that he appeared on the Megyn Kelly show. So expect that you're going to hear that kind of thing on this podcast, although there will be much more and far deeper commentary, I'm sure, on middle theory later this week. It's newsworthy and it's relevant, so it's happening, and we're talking about it on Graylin. That's how that goes. Now, I'll also say that something that Alex brought up when he went on the Joe Rogan show was this idea of a breakaway civilization. Again, loosely defined, and this term coined by our friend Richard Dolan, who, again, his program follows our own here on KGRA. So for those of you in the chat room who, actually, I don't see anybody in there asking, is Dolan live tonight? But I'll go ahead and tell you, Dolan, I think, is live tonight. Hobbs, is Dolan live tonight? Do you know if he's live? Hobbs? Hobbo? Hobbs? He must have vanished. Well, anyway, we presume that Dolan may be live tonight. So, now that said, Dolan...
from our own thoroughly uninformed bunker here.
I am about as certain that Project Mogul does explain the Roswell UFO crash of 1947. I am about as certain, similarly certain, that Dolan will be live tonight. So, that said, Alex Jones has brought up that expression, breakaway civilization. It's become kind of a buzzword as it relates to an alternative hypothesis for UFOs, and that term was coined by Richard Dolan. The premise here being that there is a contingency here on Earth with advanced technology, perhaps operating on the periphery of government, that has been able to essentially get off Earth. Now, I'm not saying they've gone spacefaring, but I'm saying that they've got a much more advanced technological apparatus at their disposal, and they're able to do things that exceed with their technology what we on the base, you know, civilian level know and understand. Now, I cannot reveal details about who or where I had this conversation, but I can tell you that on one occasion I spoke with a person who at one time had had a fairly high-level clearance. And the question I had, I didn't ask for secrets about UFOs and things like that. I simply asked this individual, I said, are there divisions of government, do you think, that exist that most others in government don't know about and that certainly the civilian public does not know about? And he said, absolutely. And he said, from my time in government, what I can tell you is that there are everything in terms of government operations occurs on a need-to-know basis. And if you operate outside of that need-to-know, you're probably not going to know about what this division or this operation or this unit or this cell is working on. And there are a variety of reasons why this very strict immediacy in terms of need to know has been useful and effective in government. But he said, absolutely, I think that there are echelons, organizations, and entities up the ladder that the civilian, of course, mind is never going to know of. But even people within government, even high-ranking people within government are not going to know about. Again, you've got a temp worker that's elected every 4 years that sits in the White House in Washington, who often doesn't know about various different government activities taking place. And so when people say there's no way in the world that there could be a so-called secret space program, or there's no way in the world there could be a breakaway civilization that involves in any way any kind of funding from government. And I'm thinking, when people say that, of course, you need to go and you need to look at Catherine Austin Fitz's article about black budgets, the new $64 question. And how she asked questions about this based on her experiences with people in government and her conversations with them about so-called UAP, unexplained aerial phenomena. Again, the bottom line is I think that there are a lot of ways that you could explain strange things seen in the skies that don't necessarily involve alien visitors. And I think it's quite telling that the majority, not all, but the majority of modern ufology doesn't begin to occur as we know it until after the Second World War.
So you're not going to say it's aliens?
I'm not going to say it's aliens because I've never seen evidence that alien technology visiting Earth is the best explanation for UFOs, while there are so many other possibilities that seem more likely, especially in terms of government secrecy and the functions of entities within government. Need to know. I'll tell you this, okay? When President Carter went to then CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush and asked him for UFO information, he was told, sir, you don't have a need to know for that information. Hello? True. And that's the thing, is that I think that in many instances, if I'm not trying to say that all UFOs are government aircraft and top secret aircraft, but I definitely think that that's a big part of it. I definitely think, and that I think that that is far more likely, okay, than aliens. Now, my friends in the UFO community in large part disagree with me. I've spoken with named and noted skeptics on this, okay, Robert Schaefer being one. And he has disagreed and said, you really believe that government would hide this from the American people? He says that information would have been released after enough time. I'm sorry, I disagree. I don't think that the government just after enough time just releases things. Guys, I mean, there are certain things about the Kennedy assassination that haven't been revealed to the public. You know, I mean, there are a lot of things about World War II that are still kept off the record due to the sensitive nature of the information. I mean, guys, I do not think that you can just say that, well, we would know about it by now if government were involved. So this idea of a breakaway civilization, although Rich told me one time in Minneapolis that he didn't necessarily endorse the idea, that he had just put that forward. Again, we have to kind of make this distinction like we were talking about in the last segment, Matt. You can present an idea or a thesis without necessarily saying that I believe this or even think that it's most likely. And so Richard proposed this idea of a breakaway civilization. I think that Richard is far more open than I, perhaps, to the alien thing. But he proposed breakaway civilization. I find it a very novel, if not a indeed perhaps a groundbreaking idea on a lot of fronts. And I also find it personally more likely than the alien agenda. Now, that said, if not already in existence, is there a possibility that at some point a breakaway civilization might come to exist? And Matthew, I think you can further enlighten us on this subject.
Well, I think one might be right under our noses at this time, and it's not even that well concealed. I don't know if you saw this, but late last year, there was an international group of scientists who had announced that they were going ahead with plans to launch the first ever private space-based nation called Asgardia.
What a great name, though.
Yeah, named after, of course, Asgard, which means Garden of the Gods.
Ah, yeah. This is from Norse mythology, the home of Thor and Loki, his brother and their dad, Odin, and his wife, Frigg.
Frigg.
Yeah. Not as epic a name, I guess, but maybe it was pronounced Fridge. I don't know. Hey, Fridge, would you get to the fridge and grab me a yaku full of ghoul, please? Thank you.
Well, this article that I saw today, and one of the reasons that it really grabbed my attention was the title is "The First Space-Based Nation, Asgardia, Plans to Illegally Store Data Off-Planet."
Oh, man, this is interesting. That's in so many different ways.
I know. I thought we should just go ahead and start the show with this conversation and go the full 2 hours, because I think we could.
Could have.
As we mentioned, it's named after Norse mythology's city in the skies, and is designed to be a permanent space station that will run asteroid mining missions and provide defense for Earth against meteorites, space debris, and other serious threats. They started recruiting back in October, claiming that the first 100,000 people to register would be granted citizenship of Asgardia alongside their nationality on Earth.
So they can have dual citizenship.
That's what it's going to look like. Now, here in a minute, I'll go into the fact that Asgardia has a website. They have 5 decrees, which is a word you don't hear too often nowadays, but they have 5 decrees where they're setting up their own constitution, everything. Declaration of Independence, all kinds of stuff.
Now, these are scientists, and they're serious.
Yes, it's dead serious. It seems surreal, but this is a real thing.
Okay.
Over 180,000 Earthlings have reportedly pledged allegiance to the planned orbital nation. The Asgardia flag, insignia, and national anthem are all currently being crowdsourced and are set to be finalized on the 18th of this month, so 6 short days.
Oh, wow, we're coming up on it. Yeah.
It plans to establish its own currency as well as calendar, which will add an extra month to our earthly 12-month calendar between June and July, called Asgard. Oh. They're really not too innovative on the name.
They aren't straying too far from the path, are they? They're keeping things right on right on course. Okay.
And at the time when it was announced, the founders said they had planned to launch a satellite called Asgardia 1 within 18 months, followed by the space station. And judging by this recent FCC filing, they're on track to get the first stage done. The document states that the group plans to launch their satellite by September 2017, piggybacking on a supply mission to the International Space Station. The tiny CubeSat satellite, measuring approximately 10 centimeters on each side and weighing about 1 kilogram, will carry 512 gigabytes of solid-state drive preloaded with data, but exactly what data it will contain is yet to be disclosed. Depending on the success of the first mission, it could open up a world of lawless data storage in space, something that Pirate Bay owners would be very interested in, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of how legal any of this is, it's all up for debate, is the thing. And this is kind of what the jumping off point I wanted to take with you, is to say the legality of so much. In the article, it even mentions a professor of international law at Western Sydney University starts postulating about the kind of moral implications of having a new country, a new, because they're planning to secede from the planet Earth. I mean, that's no joke. They're creating their own country.
This is fascinating.
So would they be held, and there are things that I was thinking about when I was reading this, if there is illegal data being stored on a space station and these people are premeditating to do it before they even leave the planet, could that be held as, I don't know, treason? Could it be held as a crime because they're currently residents and citizens of X state? Let's say the U.S., for instance. They're still bound by the laws of this state. They're not yet living under the rule of Asgardia.
But are there any laws that remove them, or rather, let me term it this way. Is there any Earth law that says they can't leave planet? I mean, I don't know that, again...
No. But storing data and things like that.
That's a good question, too. But again, are there international laws that pertain to space as it relates to storage of, or perhaps transmission of, data?
Well, if they're here when they do it and it's legal here,
yeah,
then they would kind of, I would think, be grandfathered in. You know, you've already conspired to commit this crime.
You would think.
Know? So there's so many questions that we have to pose ourselves. If we have a different country orbiting our planet, how do we treat this? And I've been reading through their documents, their decrees. So maybe this will shed some light.
I'm interested
stuff.
In these decrees. Give us a breakdown of what the decrees mean.
So I'll go through them in order. So the first decree was the appointment of the Asgardia head of nation. And it says, quote, on the 100th day of Asgardia, supported by more than 150,000 Asgardians, Igor Ashbury-Lee takes up the position of the head of nation until the constitution is adopted and elections are held.
So mote it be.
So mote it be. Decree number two is the introduction of the calendar that we had previously discussed. Decree three, announcement of the unified voting day.
I just like the echo, by the way.
Yeah. So I guess they're coming up with their own lingo for calendars, too. So it occurs on One Asgard, which I guess is the name of the month. So One Asgard Year One, which is 18th of June, according to the Gregorian calendar.
they're using this term Asgard
a lot.
Yeah. Really creative.
And there were a lot of sections of the voting regulations. This is one I found interesting. And now later on, I'll go over, they say there's no room for politics, but everybody's equal on Asgardia, right? But section 5 of the announcement of unified voting day and the decrees of voting regulations states, and I quote, those who vote in support of the Declaration of Unity of Asgardia and the Constitution of Asgardia will pass on the third level of certification and receive the right for an Asgardia ID card. In the case of disagreement with the Declaration of Unity of Asgardia and the Constitution of Asgardia, the individual will remain on the second level of verification. That sounds like some Scientology stuff to me. You know, like,
it's funny that you bring that up, because I was reading a bit about Scientology earlier today, and what was referred to as the incident, which was not the incident, but an incident was essentially something that, if memory serves correctly, an incident in Scientology would have been that when you your Thetan self from ancient times had an encounter with an alien entity, and this is remembered in your present body state. Yeah, I think essentially that is what an incident is.
So the other thing I wanted to read is they have Decree 4. Now, Decree 5 is the Constitution of Asgardia, but it hasn't been drafted at this time. But the table of contents are up, which I find kind of funny. Like, we know what we want to get to.
Yeah, we haven't written it yet.
Gotten there yet.
This is more like an outline than a...
Yeah.
Okay.
But Decree 4 is the Declaration of Unity of Asgardia. And I took down, there are about 13 points, I believe, 13 bulletins on it. I took down 5 that I found interesting.
Good. Expediency
is
a virtue in the world's most secret society.
So 3, any citizen of Earth can become a citizen of Asgardia if he concurs with this declaration, accepts the future constitution,
and can find his own way into space.
Yeah, right. And legislation of Asgardia. So pretty much if you pledge allegiance to us, then you can come here. Number 5 is Asgardia respects the laws of the states of Earth and the international agreements and wishes to be recognized as equal country among other states on Earth. Number 6, Asgardia does not interfere in the affairs of the states on Earth or on the principle of reciprocity. So basically, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Number 9, Asgardia does not engage in politics. There is no place for political parties in Asgardia, but every Asgardian can freely participate in political life on Earth, which is a bit strange to me. And number 12, there is no place for Earth history in Asgardia. This should be read in an Alex Jones voice. Asgardia creates a new history of the future of mankind. It's grandiose,
at
the very least. It's moderately delusional on some level, I think, as well.
So I'm looking around on the web because I'm trying to understand, I mean, is this really intended more as a social experiment? Is this really just a hoax? Was this an April Fool's Day prank gone wrong? But, I mean, no. By all accounts, it appears to be something real, completely...
They filed with the FCC. There's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and then, of course, we've got this report right here just from Saturday, in fact. This reported by The Express. Plans for Asgardia, a proposed nation in space independent of any country on Earth, were revealed late last year. It will comprise of the nation itself creating its own legal framework, flag, and other symbols of nationhood, with the project being developed from there, according to a statement from the team behind the idea. It is now set to take the first steps as it has been revealed that the first satellites for Asgardia will be launched later this year, and 180,000 people have signed up to become citizens of the nation. I hear some people are already crying Illuminati too, Matt.
That is true as well. You can't have a news story without a good conspiracy.
Yeah.
And it's one that just has to make you laugh. So there have been pictures of the space station, right? These depictions of what they want it to look like and things. And lo and behold, it looks like an airlock. So there's a symbol over the airlock. And the headline is, "Is Asgardia a plot by the Illuminati? Conspiracy theorists claim the space nation will be used for mind control and evil purposes." And that's all because, and I don't know if you saw this picture here, but it looks, like I said, it looks like an airlock. So it's a big circular area of the space station. And it looks like the Eye of Horus.
Yeah, I saw that. That looks let me see that again. Okay, yeah. And for folks who'd like to actually see this image, if you go to, actually just Google,
you can go to Daily Mail.
Yeah, they Daily Mail carries it and everything. Are we talking about the sort of the yellowish thing that looks like a flower there?
It's gray around it.
Oh, the gray around it looks a little like the Eye of Horus.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that does resemble the Eye of Horus. But again, the Eye of Horus being something that an ancient Egyptian symbol, but used in a variety of different esoteric groups and societies these days. I don't know. Maybe actually there is a good case to be made that the Illuminati's going up to Asgard. But here's the funny thing is, again, this parallels perfectly the existing idea of this breakaway civilization. It's good to make these comparisons here because while what they're essentially advocating, and as I've tried to wrap my head around this and understand, is this legitimate? Is this serious? Whether or not they, in effect, actualize it, are they serious about it in terms of the concept? They appear to be. That's what we're gleaning here. They appear to be serious about what they're talking about doing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Now, here's the thing. That is, by definition, a breakaway civilization. I mean, we're going to get off planet. We're going to use technology to do it. You know, we want people to swear you know, swear to me. And that's the thing is, this is very similar to this concept of an existent aspect of civilization operating on the periphery of modern humanity. If these guys actualize this, this will be the literal fruition of an idea that some, again, Richard Dolan coined this, but if this comes to pass, I mean, it's going to be fascinating because we will have a literal breakaway civilization. Now, this idea that, well, who, if they can get off planet, will be the ones likely to do this? This idea of suppression of certain technology or those who are in positions of power having more access to said technology and thereby the elites are going to be in control of something like this. This is the very reason why traditionally the Illuminati and alleged secret groups are associated with the breakaway civilization.
But the Eye of Horus thing, we immediately jump to the Illuminati. Why? Why? It's a symbol of, what is it, protection and good health,
yeah,
traditionally.
Yeah, knowledge and all sorts of things. Yeah, you know, and again, a often used esoteric symbol derived from ancient Egypt, as were many of the symbols used in various traditions, Ordo Templi Orientis, Freemasonry, a variety of different secret clandestine groups and orders over the years. The point is again, that people, when they see something like this, it's really a move toward, whether some view it as the betterment of humankind or a total reimagining of humankind, or just some of us wanting to cut out and say, see you guys, we're going to start our own little colony up here in space. There's always this concern that certain privileged individuals are going to be the ones that make the first leap. And where does that lead the rest of us? Well, it leaves us hoping that a big comet or asteroid doesn't hit, right? Here on Terra Firma. But then again, if Earth is destroyed, what will they have to orbit? And where will they get their resources? Who knows? Who knows? That'll have to be the final word for this week's edition of The Graylian Report. I remain your doctor here in the dark, hollow Earth, along with the reverend with the kind eyes, Mr. Matt Oakley. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Micah.
With the Asgard Report there, and on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Rayson, Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, Jeremy London, Chris Hayes, Jason Pentrail, and Tiffany Mack. I'm yours, Micah Hanks. It is The Graylian Report. We will catch you guys again next week, whether here, below ground, or someplace off planet. And in the meantime, I hope all you guys stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.